Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog Live here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. If you like us, you support us, you want to get some RSS feed of every single audio version of our shows that we do, go over to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. We're pumping out the RSS feed, folks. We got all kinds of shows coming, audio. We got Bog Lord Radio, 2 episodes of that up already. We got a lot of content coming your guys' way over there on the Patreon. So if you like the Bog, you support the Bog, and you want even more exclusive Bog content, make sure to go over to patreon.com/thebog and support us there. But if you want to support us another way, help us keep the lights on, help us grow our little empire here, go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. There's all kinds of cool stuff over there. T-shirts, dresses, hats, beanies, hoodies. Man, if you're in the north like me, you know it's kind of chilly right now. Make sure to go over and get yourself a Bog hoodie. There's all kinds of different designs over there. So go check it out. shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. And our boy Neil John, he's been killing it over there at the Iron Age Jodish. Man, people are really loving his work. I hear all kinds of cool stuff. People are telling me, man, he's such a great, this reading changed my life. This reading made me reflect. And, people are like, oh, man, people are loving it. And Big Dave doesn't shill for things that stink. Big Dave only shills for things that he supports and he really thinks are special and good. And I think Iron Age Jodish, Mr. Neil John, is absolutely incredible. So if you want some authentic Vedic astrology, you want to get a reading, go over to facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish. And if you decide to get your very own reading, your very own birth chart, and all that good stuff, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. So without further ado, we got a really cool show tonight. We're taking a step back a little bit from the theology, a little bit from the philosophy and the history, and we're talking about something a little bit more pragmatic, and that is modern heathen guilds. And what does that mean? Modern heathen guilds, what that means is professions that were once important to our ancestors that are still applicable today that folks can still do. And we're going to kind of go through a little bit of a list. We're going to talk about how these things can work today. And we're going to talk about what guilds are and how they worked back in the day and how they could work today. So we're going to get right into it. And we're going to start out with reading an excerpt, 2 stanzas from the Rigsthula. So this is from Rigsthula. This is in the Poetic Edda, and this is the English translation. Children reared they thus, they called them. Youth and hero, thane, smith, yeoman. Broad limb, peasant, chef beard, or sheaf beard. Neighbor, farmer, speaker, and stubbly beard. Stanza 20. By other names were the daughters called. Dame, bride, lady, gay and gaudy. Maid, wife, woman, bashful, slender. Thence are come the kindreds of Carls, saying they are the children, they are the clans of the Carls, of the guys that are beneath the Jarls, if you've read Rigsthula, if you understand Rigsthula, which it is a very important document to read. So before we dig into that a little bit, I kind of want to talk about what guilds are, the history of them, and then we're going to go over and talk about some of what's in this, and then we're going to get into professions that we can see today, and we're going to have a follow-up of this episode because our boy Folkish Farmer has been working on a very cool project talking about the ideal of the Folkish Farmer, and we're going to bring him on, and we're going to talk all about that because we all know the Folkish Farmer knows how to be a Folkish Farmer. So, Mr. Andre and Wolfman are with me tonight. Mr. Tristan, by the way, folks that didn't know, Mr. Tristan came down with COVID for a second time, and he's doing better now, but he's not quite strong enough to get back on the air. So many blessings and much love to our boy, our colleague, and our friend, Mr. Tristan. May the maiden heir bless him and bring him back to health 100% so we can have him back. Much love and many blessings to Mr. Tristan and his family. So, Mr. Andre, tell us about guilds. What are they? How they started? All that stuff. Tell us about guilds.
Well, the idea of a guild, it's kind of a organizational structure, because if you think about it historically, most cities or free states or city states, whatever, what have you, even tribes and so forth, would not really have that much of a centralized government. Even if the government was somewhat centralized, it had nowhere near the same amount of control as it does today. meaning that in case you wanted to protect your interests and you wanted to protect your specific trade, you might want to join a guild. And guilds are usually formed by like-minded individuals. Usually, in this case, it's a protective kind of agreement that is found and forged between members of the same kind of artisanal crafts, such as bakers, smiths, farmers, fishers. But farmers and fishers, maybe not that much. But definitely the more handicraft types people. If you want to compare it to more of a modern idea, you might want to compare them to something like a labor union. It was a method of trying to control not just their own rights, but simultaneously have a degree of prestige surrounding their own works. If a carpenter, let's use a carpenter as an example, joined a guild, he was held to a certain expectation of quality. If he served and did work that was beneath said quality, he might actually be liable to be punished by the guild. He might have guild privileges revoked from him. Guild privileges are also another interesting facet. Don't have to get too much into it, but the idea is basically if you join a guild, you might get certain privileges, such as titles, some degree of tax leeway, and so forth. So being part of a guild was definitely beneficial, but you have to live up to your end of the deal. If you contributed a subpar product, you might be punished, or you might actually be thrown out of the guild. And being thrown out of guild was basically a death sentence for anybody who was a craftsman or a merchant, because that means that you were dishonorable, you were not doing your best. So the idea of a guild is to create a society, a union, or a collaboration. And these guilds could get pretty huge, historically speaking, such as if you want to look at like one of the more interesting and important ones during European history, you might want to look at the Hanseatic League, which was a collection of guilds. But the idea here is that you want to control the trade somewhat, and you want to protect your own interests. So you want to create these guilds in order to create a small society, a political body of guild masters and so forth, who are leading a group of people who will protect the interests of those involved. That's basically it in summary.
So they were effectively ancient unions?
More or less, yes. They did have specific rules, rights, regulations, and so forth that only apply to the baker. Like, for instance, a baker's guild had rights and regulations related to the baker's guild. And they held people up to a pretty rigid standard. But if somebody tried to infringe on their territory, such as like another upstart baker, or the government tried to take away their rights, they formed a political body that was, in many cases, an extremely painful endeavor to deal with, because guilds could hold a lot of power.
So, another thing folks should understand, this is something that happened in the Middle Ages. The way that we understand markets today is we understand how prices, I mean, they say that it's like market forces set the price. You know, I mean, what people, how they view a product is effectively what the price is going to be. Aggregate supply and demand, so on and so forth. Back in these times, the times of the guilds, and more specifically during the time of the Middle Ages, prices were fixed. And this was something that was negotiated by guilds, by guild masters. For example, if they said, you know, it's not like today where you go on Amazon and you type on, I don't know, pencils or something, whatever. You go look up pencils, then there's going to be all kinds of different prices of pencils and this and that, blah, 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 and the prices could get undercut. They did not want to undercut with things. So the guild masters, say all the pencil guilds, got together and they said, we agree that pencils are produced at 50 cents a piece. And then what was the variable between the products was the quality. So if you went to I don't know, like the marketplace, and there was all the pencil producers. They were all at 50 cents. You were going to pay 50 cents for a pencil, but you chose which was quality. And what happened with this is this really drove quality of product up during those times. That is why Europeans developed some of the best stuff for military. You know, I mean, European armor and weapons during that time, during the Middle Ages, was the best in the world. It was the best in the world.
Can I add to that a little bit?
Absolutely.
Because this is something fairly interesting. It's something that most people actually don't realize, because when they think of the medieval age, they of course they think of it in this dystopian sense, oh, everything was bad, everything was horrible, and so forth. But also this counts very much into how people view it in the terms of economy and so forth, where people saw that the medieval age was either extremely oppressive or it was just like a economical Wild West. What was pretty interesting about these ancient guilds had modern standards. That's what I was looking for. They had modern standards in many cases when it came to quality. Quality control was very important for the guilds because this was a matter of honor and glory for them. So if one member of them would produce a bad product, they would be thrown out, punished, what have you. So being part of a guild was, of course, beneficial, but that at the same time obliged you to create goods of extremely good quality. So if you went to the market, everybody was selling, as you said, pencils for 50 pence or whatever like that. You want to go for the ones that had quality. And it was these guilds that ran these price settings, and they had the best quality goods. This is how they controlled and at the same time had a great degree of quality control over their own guild members, even sending out representatives of the guilds. If you're a part, again, of the Baker's Guild, they might send out representatives that represent the Baker's Guild to your shop out of nowhere, just to see that what you were making and what you were promising to make was actually what you were making. So if you said that your bread was 100% wheat, it better be 100% wheat, because in many cases, there were some problems where the price of things, extreme basic necessities, of course, was set. Other luxury goods might be set. Other times they were more fluctuating, but things like bread was oftentimes extremely well controlled. So you want to be able to say, yes, we sell bread for cheap, but we only use 100% wheat. Other people might be tempted to cut their own corners and cut it with something else, but not within the Baker's Guild. That would be a shortcut to disaster.
And like living in modern times, when we live with capitalism, this was effectively the opposite of capitalism. This was bottom-up economy. This was bottom-up fixed, planned economy controlled by the artisans. This is something like, you know, guys that are into syndicalism and stuff would have looked at this and been like, this isn't too far from what I'm talking about. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's not quite the opposite of capitalism. I actually was thinking about that while you guys were talking. I was thinking to myself, though, it's not really an argument for capitalism, because that involves, you know, capital ownership and credit and debting and all that sort of economic riffraff stuff that I don't care about. But this is very much, it is a controlled economy. But the thing here that makes it different from, like, you know, socialism or something, is that it's a controlled economy by the people that actually know their craft, that know the artisanship that goes into it, that know the market, that know the supply and the demand. So that alone makes it kind of more, it's not capitalist, but it's more marketable, I guess is the word that you could use. Because like you said before, that desire for quality is going to drive competition between, you know, producers of goods. Like you mentioned, you know, what some people call Noricum steel, which is the, you know, Noricum, the old Roman name for like what is now Austria. Austria, southern Germany, northern Italy, they were all known for having really high quality armor and weapons, because the quality of steel that, you know, they made from the iron that they pulled out of the ground there was just of better quality. You know, some places like Damascus steel just have better quality metals. And those were a people that, going back to the Gallic, you know, Roman days, were notoriously good smiths for weapons and armor and stuff like that. So going into the Middle Ages, you as a European nobleman or a professional soldier, you would really want to shell out the money for that quality steel, that quality weapon, because it would you'd be able to tell on the battlefield, and it could very well save your life. So in a lot of ways, the desire for maybe not perfection, but better quality drove competition in a way that was healthy for society and healthy for markets without being what we would call, you know, quote unquote, capitalism. It's just kind of like a lot of things in our worldview is, you know, heathens and whatnot. It kind of goes before classical liberalism and like modern thinking and economic systems. So to try to compare it to modern day stuff is a bit narrow. I think it's like you got to go beyond that and think of it as like a whole third route entirely. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So the way that you could understand it, if you're a modern person, and it took me a while to wrap my head around it at first. I was like, oh, because, you grow up in America. I grew up in America. And in America, we're fed the line of free markets this, free markets that, and all that stuff. So when I first heard that they had a fixed planned market, I was like, that couldn't have worked. And I started doing research. I was like, it worked very well. Because instead of driving prices down, which is what modern economies do, which is what capitalism does, when you drive prices down, eventually you drive quality down. This fixed prices and drove quality up. That's instead of the competition on the price, they had competition on the quality of the product. It's because here's another really cool thing about the guilds is the guilds were very much family owned. They were transgenerational. There was many family. This was the master craftsmen teaching their kids for many, many generations how to be master craftsmen, and they were in it for a long, long time, and it was very, very stable. And it was a really cool system that worked. And I believe that this is a system that could work again today. Now, obviously, we can't fix prices and stuff like that. That's something that's we are at the mercy of modern economies. However, I still believe that the concept of family-owned, bottom-up, collective efforts of production, centralized production, are still viable. And not only are they still viable, we have living examples of them today. For example, the Amish and the Mennonites, they have communal farms. They have communal farms that they work. They register.
They have whole communities. Can I comment on that? You're hitting something real good. So I'm really fond of the idea of like quote unquote colonies, like within existing states, like the Amish and Mennonites and whatnot. And I know a lot of people in our community want their own, I guess I would say a religious community. They want to live around other people like them, where there can be like, even if it was a small rural town, they want some place where they can be around their own kind. And everyone has this kind of shared folkishness and shared beliefs. Not out of xenophobia or anything like that necessarily, but just out of the very normal human desire to want to be around your own kin and kith. So the thing is that you don't need, like you said, we can't fix prices, but we can fix through, you know, freedom of association or what remains of it. We can fix who we patronize. So like if you know a smith or a carpenter or, you know, someone in the Scythian or, you know, heathen community that you want to support, do it. Like, support their goods, support their services, because you're helping your kinsmen out. Ultimately, you're helping yourself out, and you're fostering ties within the greater community, which is great. And increasingly, you know, I don't want to get real political, but as the socio-civic situation breaks down even further, you're really going to want to have those community ties that go beyond, you know, just shared religion or just shared political ideology in a political system that's failing. You're going to want concrete, familial, economic, social ties. And like you were saying about, you know, these businesses and stuff, a lot of times being family affairs, that helps not only the quality of the good, you know, be more or less constant because they're learning father to son and so on and so forth. But it fosters ties for generations. You know, like I think distant relatives of mine that live around you, they own like a lumber yard or something like that. And they have for a long time. I have no tire connection to that, but I still think it's cool that you and your community, even, you know, 2,000 miles away from where I live now, there's still that kind of echo of that kind of living still here in North America. And there's no reason we can't bring that back through patronizing each other's goods and services. It's not like a libertarian argument or like a capitalist argument. It's just support your kin.
It's a folkish argument.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a folkish. And I coined this. I've put it out there, and I'm going to continue to yell it you know, I want everybody to yell it. I want everybody to repeat it. Support folk economy. Support folk economy. That needs to become a mantra of our communities. You need to support folk economy. Every time you spend a dollar in the folkish economy, you are supporting folkism. Every time you support, you spend a dollar outside of the folk community, you are stealing from the folk community. And now, obviously, the folk community doesn't provide certain things. You don't have a folkish. There's not like a folkish, you know, producer of, you know, RAM sticks for your computer. We're not there yet. Where there's not really any folkish watchmakers or I don't know. You guys know what I'm talking about. There's not really a whole lot, but we're starting to get into technology. We're starting to see guys that are getting into hosting websites, guys that are getting into programming and coding. We got some guys that are doing that. We have guys that do all kinds of things. We have craftsmen. We have blue-collar workers. We have electricians. We have carpenters. We are starting to step into big boy economy stuff, which is really, really exciting. So I think that the next piece is this collective effort, this family transgenerational effort. We need to get away from this idea of the nuclear family. We need to get away from this idea of, and when I say nuclear, get away from the nuclear family, I mean away from the nuclear family and into the extended family. We need to have the clan system. And on top of that, we need to take a step into we need to get rid of this idea of, oh, I go to college and become whatever I want, blah, 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 blah. No, bro, you do what your father teaches you. You do what your father teaches you, and you and your uncle and your dad and your kinsman and your neighbor and these people all work together doing the same thing. You all work together producing this product, and then you all profit. And that profit goes to all of your families, and then you teach your sons, he teaches his sons, so on and so forth, forever and ever, until you become an institution, a financial and an economic institution of both power and stability that will go on for many, many generations. That is what
if you don't. Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, if you don't have a craft, like if your father didn't pass on his own or whatever, like for example, mine and all my uncles are like construction workers. I have an interest in smithing and metalworking. I had no one to pass that on to me. That's just kind of a self-born interest. But if you have that kind of goal or interest in mind, you can find someone to just apprentice yourself to, like in an economic career sense, and then take that knowledge and kind of turn it back to the folk. For example, there are, you know, heathen smiths, you know, Satru smiths and stuff that I very much would like to network with and, you know, maybe apprentice myself under if I could. But if not, there's a lot of stuff locally, even if they're mostly focused on making horseshoes and things like that. But it's just a stepping stone. And you can always reach out to people in the community. Like, don't be afraid to do that. I wouldn't speak for any of these people personally because, you know, they're artisans and they can dictate what they want to do themselves, of course. But you shouldn't be afraid to want to learn or to want to network. Like, that's something that's really important, especially going forward, like Dave was saying.
Yeah. And on this, I want to move on after this. The final thing I'll say about it is everybody knows, I'm sure you've met a guy with the last name Miller. You know why his last name was Miller? It's because his ancestors and all his ancestors' families worked at a mill together. That's why their name is Miller. So real quick, we got Walking All Over You. Our boy donated 7 lemons. I want to go on to, because we're like halfway already. So I want to get right into talking about what was here in the stanzas from the Rigsthula. Children reared, they thus they called them. Youth and hero, thane, smith, yeoman, broad limb, peasant, sheaf beard, neighbor, farmer, speaker, and stubbly beard. By other names were the daughters called, dame, bride, lady, gay, gaudy, maid, wife, woman, bashful, slender. Thence are come the kindreds of Carls. So, Mr. Andre, let's dig right into, we could talk about some of the things that were listed here, as well as we came up with a list as well of professions that were around and were important to the communities of our ancestors that are still viable today. And I want to talk about how they can still be viable and what they entail. So, Mr. Andre.
Yeah, of course. When we're talking about this, we're talking about in the modern sense, we'd like to think of it as like it's a job, it's a career. But we have to go back into the mindset of these people who were talking about this, who lived through this. This wasn't just a job. This wasn't just a career. This was their life. This was their livelihood. This is the entire concept of livelihood here. This idea that this is what you do to live. And if, as was said, it was passed down from father to son and from son to grandson and so forth. Such as like where you get names like Miller or names like Smith and so forth. Basically, if your name is reminiscent of some sort of old career, that's because that was their that family's livelihood. So in a modern sense, in 2021, the modern age, we like to think that we are, of course, better than these ancient people. However, I don't necessarily believe that's true, in that sense that we want to somewhat emulate what they did in some cases. And some of these career choices, some of these livelihoods that they had could be translated into a modern age. And at first, I guess I would want to start with the very basic. I guess we will touch more upon this later, but something like a farmer or an artisan. Like, I want to focus more on the artisan, the creator. The creator, or the, again, the artisan, is someone who, it's a compound word. It's a word that describes a lot of different types of careers. This could be someone like a carpenter. And a carpenter can mean someone who does intricate work, or it can mean someone who builds houses, something like what we would know as a construction worker. It could be a tailor or a metal worker of some sort, and so forth. It's basically, if you create something with your own hands, I would say that's a very important skill to master for most people. And some people are going to be able to do it. They're going to be able to do it well. But in most cases, they might not necessarily be able to master it except with a lot of practice, if they have the passion for it. But the artisan is a very important figure, I think, in any sort of community that you want to establish. Someone who is able to make clothing that's not just very basic, or someone who is able to put up a house. Because anybody, I think anybody is able to put up a square block of wood and call it a house. It's technically a house, but it lacks that essence. It lacks that finesse. It lacks that final touch. What makes it truly a house instead of just a dwelling? Same thing with clothing. Clothing is something that's often overlooked because nobody wants to really talk about it, because fashion has been generally associated with something like somewhat effeminate. But we have to remember, our ancestors were really fond of fashion. They really liked fashion. We shouldn't think of high fashion like you see on like the runways of Paris or whatever like that. We should think of something that was finely crafted and especially colorful. Our ancestors liked colors, and we want people to be able to create clothing, because a homemade clothing, contrary to popular belief, would actually last you a lot longer than conventional clothing. Conventional clothing that we buy today, modern clothing and so forth, it's not going to last. It's not going to last very long. Things were built to last before. And this is basically the essence of the artisan. They make something, they build something, they create something with their own hands. That is, I would say, honestly, divinely inspired. Because if you see an artisan at work in their craft, it's a magnificent sight. It's enthralling to see. Because you see someone who is able to almost push or communicate with the divine to create something extraordinary out of nothing. A plank of wood, a lump of iron, a piece of fabric, and they are able to create something that's truly beautiful. And I honestly believe that is absolutely part of the divine. It's divine inspiration in a way.
Well, I mean, that the gods are the ones who taught crafts to man, you know, so it's like it makes sense. I agree with you 100%. It's in a way, music is like that too. It's not really a craft, but when you think about the science of music or something, it's really just vibrations and stuff like that. But the fact that it can evoke emotion and imagination and have so much power over people that you can measure it with scientific, you know, results, that seems divinely inspired to me as well. And I think like Tolkien wrote that, you know, Ilvatar or whatever, you know, the name of God is in Lord of the Rings, sang creation into existence, more or less.
Yeah, and we, you know, you mentioned music. On this list, we have a few things that are cultural things that we in the modern society, we have become very, you know, pragmatic, coldly. We become cold calculators that don't value things that don't have inherent value, that don't give us instant physical pleasure. You don't value a guy that plays music until you hear him playing music. You don't value a gavi until you need a gavi, until you need to talk to somebody after your family member just croaked. Yeah, you know, I mean, you don't value a scald until he's teaching you the poetry and he's reciting things and he's singing. You don't value these. Our ancestors valued these things as necessities. You know what I mean? How could you live without music? How could you live without learning the teachings from a priest? How can you live without a warrior? How could you live without being martial yourself? So these are things that I think, you know, we were talking about this. These are three: the scald, the gavi, and the warrior are three things that aren't necessarily 100% needed in your material modern existence, but they are things that have great cultural value and things that we need to start putting monetary value into. Like, I was in a chat pretty recently, and there was, this couple, they're getting ready to get married and stuff like that. And they're talking, and these weren't heathens people, but they were talking about, you know, this guy saying, oh, me and my wife get married. And this guy's like, hey, I have a band. Like, we do weddings sometimes. We'll fly out and do it. And there he's like, all right, well, how much? He's like, it costs, you know, I mean, with everything, well, we can do it for $1,500. And he's like, oh, that's too steep. I'll just get a DJ. And I was thinking, it's like, you know, how much does your wedding cost? You know, I mean, your wedding is very expensive. You can have live music guys that specialize in playing music at your wedding, and you don't want to pay $1,500 for this guy to do it. You know, it's like we don't value those things. You know what I mean? And we need to start valuing those things. You know, a warrior. Like, how many people here, like, take martial arts? You know what I mean? How many people here are, like, learning how to take care of their guns and go shooting? How many people here are good at wrestling? Like, our ancestors, if you put rando ancestor and against another rando ancestor, they both can wrestle. They both know how to folk wrestle. They did it from when they were kids. And they very much, you know, it's part of their culture, folk wrestling and fighting and like all that stuff. It's part of their culture. You know, I mean, as like sports kind of became for us, but now we don't even play sports. We don't do anything. We don't do anything now. We are completely just like solitary and what's the word for it when you just sit around all the time? I can't remember. It doesn't matter. But we need to start valuing those things. Like, have somebody that is what we call a gunari, which is somebody that teaches martial prowess, somebody that teaches the craft of war. This person, you know, you should, you know, value this person. Like, hey, please teach me this stuff. I'll pay you X amount. So these people can also become profitable. Because until we put economic power and economic energy into these very important cultural pillars, we will continue to be vanilla husks.
Absolutely. I would say that, like, the economic incentive thing is definitely a boon. But for the folkish community and mindset, I would argue, too, that even if it costs you a little bit, it's always good to just help people with stuff. Like, I mean, in my own social circle, I'm kind of known as something of a gun nut. And so I've helped people learn to shoot, you know, when they first get a gun, or if they don't own one, they want to learn how and stuff like that. I don't really have a problem if I have the income disparity, you know, buy 100 rounds just for them to practice with and stuff like that, because I enjoy, well, I mean, I just enjoy the activity, period. But I also get a sense of satisfaction of, you know, I'm helping someone learn how to defend themselves. I'm helping someone learn how to maintain their tools of war. I'm helping someone, especially in the case of my male friends, like, I'm helping them kind of reclaim a portion of their masculinity that modernity is trying to snuff out. Because, and the blunt truth is this, like, if you don't know how to fight, and I'm not telling everyone to go be a thug or nothing, but if you don't know how to fight, you're not doing your duty as a man to yourself, to your wife, to your children, to your community, to your ancestors, because every man is expected to, you know, be in the shield wall, more or less. So that's my expectation. And I feel like given the lore and the stories we have and the historical cultural traditions we have, it is very much explicitly clear that it is the God's will, that it's the will of, you know, our society and our ancestors for every man to be in the shield wall. There's no excuse, barring, you know, physical lameness or something like that, to not be in it. And even if there is, then you can participate or be helpful in other ways, like, you know, through craftsmanship or something like that.
Yeah, there's... And you mentioned something there. You said the will of the gods. You mentioned the gods' will. Yeah. That is something that, you know, we need to really put that into our minds when we choose to do things. You know what I mean? We need to understand that when we take on this faith and you pick up that badge of heathen and you put it on, or if you're Sedish or Alsatru or whatever you identify, you are now, you would now serve the gods. You serve them. You are their... What's
it's
that?
Absolutely, it's not easy. Like, I mean, honestly, I spent all of this morning kind of complaining to Andre that, man, all the stuff I'm trying to do is hard. It takes a lot of investment and time. But that in itself is good, because it's like, if you have to work that hard at something, if you have to inject that much passion and, you know, essence of yourself into something, then like Andre was saying, it becomes something of a divine work. If you're a smith and you kind of put yourself into your craft, then, you know, those things are kind of... they're better. Like, the quality might be better, but also there's almost like a spiritual significance to it. Like, back in the day, like all these famous swords that we have, like Gram and like, you know, Tyrfing and stuff like that, they're always made by people who are like emotional or that have a reason to do it. Like when Regan reforges Gram from the shattered pieces for Sigurd, he's doing it with like wrath and malice in his heart. So in a way, it almost makes the sword more dangerous, you know, able to kill Fafnir in a single thrust. So that kind of thing, I think, is really important. So when you do take on a craft, even if you think maybe like, because a lot of neo-pagan stuff is very much aesthetic. They really, especially with pop culture, they like to drive up people's need to feel like a tough Viking warrior, when like tough Viking warrior doesn't have, you know, anything without the smith who makes his goods. And that's something a lot of people forget, and I think they need to be reminded of. And it's a lesson of the Rig Stula, is that everyone has their place. Even if you're not necessarily a fan of where you've been placed, ultimately it's kind of a spiritual duty to accept it and to play that role as best you can.
And it's your job to work in harmony with the other roles. You know what I mean? I've seen people like, oh, but you see a guy that like he like works out and he posts pictures of himself wearing the face paint. He's just like a Viking LARPer. He's like, everybody else is a weakling. Blah, blah. No, idiot. The weaklings are there for you to protect. That was your job. Yeah. That is your job still today. You don't get to walk around and badmouth guys that are carpenters. You don't get to badmouth guys that do theological studies. You don't get to badmouth guys that are working and doing this. You don't get to badmouth mothers. Shut your mouth and use your job. You know what I mean?
It's a body. Society is a body, and all the organs need to work in concert to make the thing function well. Like, oftentimes I compare Andre to Sam Tarly from Game of Thrones, and he hates it because he thinks I'm calling him a coward or not martial. But what I'm actually calling him is very scholarly and very wise. And we need people that are wise and scholarly. We need people that have all aspects to work together to do things. Some people are martial, some people are not. Some people are wise, some people are not. Some people are creative, some people are not. Everything needs to work in synergy.
So related to that, like, I want to add, like, in case like people feel like if you're talking about Rig Stula, you're talking about like how the social classes of our ancestors came to be. And a lot of people, of course, there is like this idea that everybody wants to be Jarl. Everybody wants to be the Lord. Everybody wants to be the nobleman. But they fail to realize that the nobleman has just as much, if not more work than a Carl to do, because you can't just sit down and enjoy your luxury. You have responsibilities. You have duties that you have to attend to. And the duties and the responsibilities of a Jarl is far more taxing emotionally and physically than that of a Carl in some cases.
It's a burden.
Yes, exactly. It's a burden. And simultaneously, it's a burden to be a Carl as well. But that's what you have to be able to overcome. you have to also just be able to sit down, think, and realize that if you want to be a carpenter, if you want to be a smith or something like that, like a farmer or something like that, nobody should be able to look down upon you if you are truly a master of your craft. The idea of being a master of your craft, it brings a great degree of honor and esteem to whatever you're doing. Being a master smith will in some cases even bring you into legend. Being a master scald will also bring you into legend. There is something here that people have to understand, that being in a physical line of work, and this is very typical of modernity, people think that physical crafts, be that modern day carpenters or electricians or plumbers or whatever it should be, it's a low task because it doesn't require any sort of brain power. It doesn't require any sort of skill set. Oh yeah, like you went to trade school for 3 years. What's the big deal? I went to university for 7 and I haven't gotten a job yet. So they somehow think that having more education and spending more time will yield them more results than someone who actually does something with their craft and is actually good at it. That's something I want to like reiterate, and I want to repeat it in infinity to make sure that people realize that if you want to take up a physical craft, do it. There is absolutely no dishonor in it. It's almost a dishonor not to do it if you're good at it.
Well, look at the, even in the lore, you have stories of the exaltation of that kind of craftsmanship. I mean, the contest of the artists between the sons of Ivaldi and Etrian Brock and all that. I mean, you can't say that, you know, smithing is a lowly profession when, you know, it's exalted by the gods. Like they declare, you know, these treasures that are made, Mjolnir in particular, to be like the greatest things in all of creation, like, you know, regarding physical goods and whatnot. So if it's something that the gods themselves esteem, how can you possibly look down on it?
Yeah. And, you know, and I want to clarify, because a few minutes ago I got shouting about, you know, Viking bros that call people weaklings and stuff like that. That's not a swipe at all martial people at all. I know groups of guys that do martial things that are great. Dave Litz, we've had him on the show. Our colleague at Nerona Society, him and Focus Farmer, they run the Three Mahal. They are excellent. They are excellent. You know, I know some guys that run this thing called Black Market Strength. They're excellent. These guys, if you go and you knock on their door and you say, teach me, their door is open. They're not doing that for themselves to give themselves an ego boost. They're doing it to spread strength and knowledge to people. And they do it right. So what I don't like are these rugged individualist Viking bro douchebags that do it just so they could like post pictures, post selfies, and jerk themselves off about how great they are and look down on people. And that, to me, that's a trait of weakness in itself. That's a trait of guys with great strength don't need to flex it. You know what I mean? Like
it's insecurity. They need to wave their ego so that everyone knows they're strong and tough, when people that are actually strong and tough don't care what you think.
Guys that have strength and guys that have power and guys that wield influence, they don't need to treat people badly. And in fact, people that are truly masters of what have you, they are there. They know that their duty is to teach others and to bring this, to keep the craft alive. They're like keepers of the flame.
Well, that's, you know what I mean? We all do. I mean, you're not to speak for you, but, you know, your goal with a lot of stuff is to keep alive the craft of what I would call maybe like, you know, the scald, you know, the poetry and the singing and the music relevant to our people and our culture. With me, it's more of a martial bend, especially with regards of creation of tools and stuff, like with the smithing thing. Andre and Tristan have their own specialties, more focused on, you know, theological text and, you know, runic translations, very academic and theologian type things. And I just love being in this community and seeing all these different people with their varied interests working together to create stuff that's awesome.
Exactly. This is what separates the Seddish community from from other communities is we have all of these brilliant minds, all of these experts and people, and there's nobody trying to like step on anybody else. It's like if I have a question about martial arts or whatever, I'll call some of the Threema guys. If I have a question about theology, I'll call some of the theology guys. If I have a question about, you know, homesteading, growing my garden, taking care of animals, carpentry, welding, you know, whatever. There's a guy for that. I can call people and ask them and lean on their expertise and allow them to teach me. And it is a community of teachers all teaching each other. And it is something I've never seen before, and it's absolutely incredible. So, and you mentioned the Scald. And this is a profession that folks nowadays would be like, well, why would you need a Scald? Well, I think that there is a pretty cool interpretation of how a Scald can operate in modern times. Like, what was a Scald back in the day? A Scald was a guy that kept stories and wrote songs of legend. He was a poet. He was a guy that he was the keeper of legends. So what could a Scald be today? I mean, we don't need that anymore.
Oh, you're being ironic. Sorry. Well, I was going to say that, you know, a modern day Scald, like something I think would be cool. A lot of people love music and they love metal, especially in this community. They like metal and they like folk music. I've always thought it would be cool for someone to literally put a band together where they quite literally had songs where the lyrics were just the poetry, like sung in Old Norse or even maybe English or modern Danish or I don't know, whatever. But, you know, just brought about in a way that it's very much a modern incarnation of what it would have been back then. So, you know, in a lot of ways, Dave, and again, I don't mean to speak for you, you're a very musically inclined person. You love to play instruments, you love to sing. And so you, if anything, are that kind of modern iteration. Like, you're not so much a theologian like someone like Tristan would be, but you're that guy that wants to memorize the poetry and memorize the sagas and put it to song and, you know, entertain and educate people with it. And that's really a central pillar of society, if you ask me, because that's a society's heart and soul is found in its culture and its traditions and its epics. And it needs people like you to keep that alive, just as much as it needs theologians to keep the lore alive and, you know, people like Folkish Farmer to keep the agricultural traditions alive, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the Scald is, you know, a people without music is a people without flavor, is a people without a spirit.
They're not people, in my opinion.
but we have lost a lot of that. You know, there was a time we were a very musical people. There was a time where everybody was dancing and everybody could play a little something. Everybody knew how to sing. Now music is lost on people. It's considered to be an unnecessary thing. You know what I mean? Everybody likes music.
It's the domain of art and pleasure when it's not.
It's not. It's an expression of the folk soul. And like if you suggested, hey, let's get together and let's play some music and dance, people are like, dance. You know, I mean, because they have that stain of cultural Protestantism, or that dancing poetry is dirty.
Poetry too. You know, nowadays when, you know, you say to someone, hey, I like writing poetry, they're going to think of like Shakespeare or like some kind of ballad, ooey gooey stupid thing, when you might very well be talking about like epic verse, like Sigurd the Dragon Slayer or Beowulf type of poetry. But because of that cultural stagnation, that cultural contagion, you know, cultural Protestantism, I guess, there's this idea that, you know, poetry inherently is almost kind of quasi feminine, and it's the domain of artists and authors that have nothing better to do than sit around and be emo and stare out a rainy window and write their feelings in a poem. When I think, you know, and if you really read the primary source, you know, the Poetic Edda and whatnot, if you read it in verse, it's a lot better. It kind of takes a bit of time to like kind of acclimate to that style. But once you do, it really, like, the artistry shines through. And another way, like, I'm obsessed with like the tradition of swordsmithing and whatnot. I think it's really awesome how poetic our people have always been, both in language and expression. Like, the word for sword is literally gram, but there's all these, like, you know, references to it being like Tyrfing is like, you know, finger of the gods kind of thing. Or, you know, like swords that are named for like qualities like wrath and things like that. And so there's a word for sword, or brand, sorry, I meant brand is the word for sword. Gram is the word for wrath. So you have swords that you can literally call a sword, but you can also call it, you know, all these poetic allegories and metaphors for the same thing. And it just shows that when a language functions like that, these are people that are inherently very artistic, very poetic in expression.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe that a modern scald could do many things. He could be somebody that, and you know, I don't see that there's anything wrong with emotional or beauty. We have come to this conclusion that creating beautiful things is gay. It's not gay. You know, creating beautiful things was something that was regarded as a divine gift. You know what I mean? We look at, you know, I mean, and Tristan said this before, you know, I'm not gonna quote him here because this is something that'll get us kicked off of D-Live. But these things aren't gay. They're not feminine. These are things that were the arena of warriors. You know, warriors wrote poetry. Yeah. Warriors sung songs.
I was going to say that. It always really, I don't mean to step on you, but it's always chapped me really bad when, like a lot of those Viking bro dudes you're talking about, like, oh, poetry, literary stuff, that's lame. It's like, how do you think you know the story of these famous warriors? Like, how cool is it that, you know, we have recollections of like literal bands of Vikings or Germanic warriors who would charge into battle singing as a collective? People greatly underestimate like morale and psychological stuff, especially on the battlefield. If you're an ancient Roman and a bunch of like half naked painted dudes are all like singing and chanting in unison as they like roll at you, it's kind of intimidating. And for them, it's very much like invigorating. Like, if you're ever at a metal show or something like high energy, like, you know, I know it fits the stereotype, but Amon Amarth is really great live. There's an energy when you're moshing and when, you know, you're getting hyped up on all that stuff where you feel that kind of quasi high or like just that exuberance, like that ability to like almost be vaguely not superhuman, but, you know, better than you are. Like you have increased stamina, you have increased energy, and it's very much a psychosomatic response to the music, to the crowd energy.
Yeah, it's...
Well, yeah, like... sorry.
Go ahead. It's just, we got a couple minutes left. Go ahead, Andre.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, in case somebody wants an example of, like, the archetypical skull that we have, like, in, like, the ancestral memory, you shouldn't think of, like, this overly sensitive dude or whatever like that. You should think of someone like Egil Skallagrimson. Egil Skallagrimson was, by all means, what could be considered an absolute badass. But he could also, he could bust a rhyme that could make people want to contemplate to kill themselves. He could impress whoever. What?
There's no shame beating the game with the bard then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. Like, he could bust a rhyme that could make people kill themselves. He could sing a song that would inspire armies. And at the same time, the guy was a warrior. He was a hero in many aspects. So, like, this is the archetypical skull that people think of, like, in ancient times. Like, that's who we should think of in modern times as well. Like, not some overly sensitive dude that is way too connected to his feelings, that's all cries and all tears all the time.
It's very Odinic in a way too, right? Though, like that, you know, singing a song that inspires an army or demoralizes the enemy into hurling themselves off a cliff. That's like that kind of divine wind, you know, that breath of Odin, that manic inspiration. I feel like it's a tendril of that sort of energy, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, like, according to the myth, it was Odin who brought back the meat of poetry to mankind, right, exactly, and the gods.
Exactly.
You know, I think it's time to get rid of, and I'm not saying let's all be touchy-feely, like, little, you know, jellyfish or anything like that, but I don't understand, like, even just, I had this book, okay? So I had this book. It was a compilation of letters that Civil War soldiers wrote home. And it was such a cool, I don't know what happened to it. I was actually looking for it recently. But it's out there somewhere. I'm sure people can find it. And in this book, most of the letters were love letters that soldiers wrote to their, like, fiancé, because they were mostly young men, to their fiancés or newlywed wives or their wives, period. That's overwhelmingly what the letters were love letters. And just the passion that these guys wrote, and they, because these were guys, a lot of them were actually from Gettysburg. So these were guys that were fighting in one of the most bloody, brutal, you know, battles that had one of the highest mortality rates ever in American history. Tons of people died here. So these are guys that were facing their mortality every day, and they just did not care about whether or not they looked like pussies or whether or not they looked like, you know, gay or whatever. They were like, I love my wife, and I want to, you know, to express it to her. And it's very moving to hear a man that is very possibly very close to his death. You write these letters, and then at the bottom of the letter, it would specify if they returned home or whatever. So and so was released from service on this day. So and so was never found. So and so was like missing in action or whatever. So and so was buried at this plot at this time. So it's like you read this, and it's like this person never came home, and it was like it was really really moving. And I don't see why there can't be a masculine expression of passion, a masculine expression of beauty. Why can't masculinity be dynamic like it once was for our ancestors? And that's a whole nother topic, but we're running out of time.
Yeah, it can and will, but we have to be the harbingers of that.
Yeah, so that's my take on it. Mermaid says, Hail Odin, Hail Odin. Mermaid donates 3 ice creams, 2 more ice creams, 5 ice creams. We got... I know we had a dono up here that I missed. I was running my mouth, and then we passed off the mic. And Molar Bear donated an ice cream. Much love and many blessings to each and every one of you and your many generous donations. Ancestral Weapons says, men were much freer with their emotions before feminism, it seems. Absolutely true, 100%. But anyway, folks, close it down for this evening. Siprosity just coming in. Missing us, bro. You missed us, but you could check. All you guys could check this out, and he donates an ice cream. You could check out this podcast over on YouTube, on my YouTube channel. I'm going to do a replay. It's over there live. And then after that, if you want to hear it, it'll be over there. Or you could go sign up at our Patreon and get audio of every single show that we do. So you could get it comes from an RSS feed. So you can hook it up into I use an app called Pocket Cast. It's free. It uploads it immediately. You can get the RSS feed. So you could get audio of every single show that we do to listen to in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. You can sign up patreon.com/thebog. Help us keep the lights on. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And it's great stuff over there. We have so much extra exclusive content over there. There's exclusive content, more of it coming your way. If you want to support the Bog another way, you can go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and go check out some sweet merch. We got t-shirts, we got dresses, we got all kinds of stuff. Hoodies, hats, beanies, backpacks, whatever you can think of is over there. Go over to check out shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop, and you can support our friend facebook.com/ironagejodish. I'm telling you, this guy is incredible. Go over, check him out. If you decide to get a reading from him, make sure it's authentic ancient Vedic astrology. If you decide to get a reading from him, I swear it's not kooky new age stuff. This is real deal stuff. It's going to blow your mind. Facebook.com/ironagejodish. If you decide to get a reading, tell him Big Dave sent you. Well, anyway, that's going to be it for tonight. This was The Bog right here, DLive.tv/Dave Martell, every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Much love, many blessings to each and every one of you. We got to go.